Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today it's the man who crisscrossed India to bring us the final word on curry. Raghavan Iyer lays out the authentic building blocks of India's iconic dish. His latest book is 660 Curries, The Gateway to the World of Indian Cooking. Our wine maverick, Josh Wesson, talks the wines that like to be jostled and quaffed, as opposed to being coddled and sipped, the picnic wines. It's the artichoke brief from Russ Parsons. For instance, did you know that they come from just one town? And he's got some bargain advice, too. Now, MSG, could this seasoning under any other name become the darling of we culinary types? Wait until you hear what New York Times reporter Julia Moskin unearthed. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. The Sterns write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
We were just down in Texas 2 weeks ago and found an unheralded, unknown, unsung about pie company, which in Texas is unusual because, you know, if something's good, it becomes front page news in Texas. Found this great pie company in Kylie, Texas.
Kyle.
And probably had some of the best pies I have ever eaten.
Is this like a restaurant or is it a bakery?
Teeny weeny.
It's a teeny restaurant with a kind of minimal eat there menu, sandwiches and salads, really, but maybe two dozen different kinds of pie that they make. We were drawn to it for two reasons. One is driving through Kyle. We were actually on our way to eat Great Barbecue, but we were on our way through Kyle, and there on the storefront was a gigantic three-dimensional piece of cherry pie kind of sticking out over the sidewalk, a statue of one. So that caught our attention. And right around that piece of pie is the motto of the Texas Pie Company, which is, life is short, eat more pie.
I agree.
I agree, too. Where is Kyle located?
It's about halfway between Austin and San Antonio. And actually, if you're traveling on Interstate 35, it's right there. It's just a hop off of Interstate 35. And it's a little town. I mean, I don't know what else Kyle has to offer.
I think King Ranch is right around there. Do you know, Lynn, do you know the King Ranch?
I've heard
of it. The famous King Ranch?
Yeah, I've heard of it. Yeah.
Because this little Texas Pie Company restaurant actually serves King Ranch chicken casserole, which I have seen in every Western cookbook I've ever owned going back to the 1950s.
But never seen in a restaurant. I do have to amend what Jane said. They don't serve it. If you want King Ranch casserole, you can get it there to take home, but they don't at the restaurant. They don't serve anything that elaborate, just sandwiches.
But tell me about the pies.
Okay.
All right. Well, the pecan pie.
And I'm honestly not a major pecan pie fan, but this was off the charts.
Well, you know, Texas is pecan country.
Right.
I think it's the second largest grower of pecans in the country. And what's great about the pecan pie is that the top is crowded with nuts. You know how pecans on pecan pie can get kind of mealy and soft?
Yeah.
These are
yeah.
nice and crunchy, and they have that kind of freshness, like you just opened a shell and are eating pecans.
And huge. I mean, they're absolutely Texas-sized pecans.
The place most pie places fall down for me is the crust.
Oh, no.
Yes, I totally agree with you. I could just eat crust and
yes,
basically throw
yes.
the interior
And I have
away.
Been known to do that, Jane. You should know this. You know,
No, these are really good crusts. I mean, they're hand-crimped. I don't think they have lard in them. They didn't have that super savory character.
I think they're Crisco.
But they were nice and flaky and kind of light. You know, they don't get, like, cardboard at the bottom, even
right.
underneath the fruit pies, which is nice. The one other thing I do have to say, in addition to pie, there was something we couldn't resist. They had a strawberry cake there that was unbelievably good. It was just, we got a square of it.
It was like a sheet cake.
It was a sheet cake, a strawberry cake with strawberry frosting, strawberries in the frosting and in the cake, and it was so moist. I haven't had a strawberry cake like this ever, maybe. It was just like an incredibly good cake.
It was just the great classic road food find. And sometimes I think they're getting harder to find, but this was a 4-star one.
Hey, guys, thank you.
Okay.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Just a piece of pecan pie. Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you know you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can check out their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. So here's a question. Which is kinder, drink your fish live or electrocute them first? Gross, right? Well, not to animal rights activists in Belgium. They want to ban live fish drinking, but electrocution is the compromise they offer to the people of the village of Gerardsbergen. Now, this town has a spring religious festival that started in pagan times. Part of it is swigging down red wine with tiny live fish in it. It's said that this symbolizes the bringing of spring's new life into the body, along with the wine symbol of being the blood of Christ. The International Herald Tribune did a story on the fish drinking. It explains that the animal rights people say the fish suffer in the wine. The Belgian government ruled against the practice. The ruling was overthrown, and now it's back. Well, sort of. The town limits fish drinking to just 5 people. And by the way, one is the local priest who drinks his guppies out of a chalice. The town claims this is their ancient tradition and it should not be stopped. Not to take sides, but I don't think the fish like the tradition or the compromise. Joshua Wesson is a wine expert turned maverick. He thinks wine is a democratic drink, something you should enjoy with anything, you know, from Big Macs to maybe Thai takeout. And he believes there's a lot of good wine to be had out there for not a lot of money. Joshua is co-creator of Best Sellers Wine Shops, and he stops by regularly to answer our questions and share his finds. Hey, Joshua, good to have you back.
Good to be back with you.
Hey, Joshua, what's your take on picnic wines? You know, wines that I guess can be jostled and moved around.
My best case scenarios, as it were. Well, you know, I mean, picnics these days can be pretty fancy, but I still am a simple man and I have simple needs. When I think of picnic baskets and the things that come out of there, the foods usually have elements that are salty, sometimes a little bit sweet. A lot of things can have sauces that are pungent, maybe sweet and sour. You think about
you know,
the wonderful tuna salads, but there's, you know, the fat from the mayo. Maybe you throw in a little bit of relish in there. And there's always veggie stuff, whether it's as simple as, you know, crudité and raw carrots and celery sticks or fancy salads. I mean, you've got all this stuff. You've got cold meat sitting in the picnic hamper. Could be a meatloaf sandwich. Could be a cold steak. It could be a million different things.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Pate.
And coleslaw, which is a challenge.
Coleslaw. You know, you basically have a lot of different things that are coming out of the basket, going onto the table. So you don't want to have a car full of wine to deal with all of this stuff. I mean, let's face it, it's a picnic. You don't want to get fancy, put your pinky out, and try to match each dish to a specific wine. But there are wines that I think can really do well sitting on a table with all this stuff that that just, you know, make everything taste more delicious. And that's really what you want to do. You don't want to think about the wine. You just want to put it in a paper cup and, you know, tuck into the sandwich or the pate and just kick back and go jump in the hammock and sway back and forth and say that all is good with the world.
So which wines are we talking about here?
Well, you know, you want to find, for the green stuff, you want to find wines that sort of flatter all the green stuff in a basket. And it could be a salad. It could be, as I said, celery.
Right.
And I love cool climate Sauvignon Blancs that come from places like the northern part of France up in the Loire Valley. Or, as everybody knows these days, a great, great source of cool climate Sauvignon Blanc, New Zealand.
Oh, yeah.
Especially
yeah.
the South Island of New Zealand. And a place that some people are just beginning to recognize as perhaps taking the mantle from New Zealand in terms of producing cool climate Sauvignon Blancs, and at a very modest price, I may add, South Africa, especially up in and around the Stellenbosch. There's a raft of really wonderful Sauvignon Blancs coming from there. But I would say that the stuff that I'll be drinking with my next picnic is going to be coming from Chile, because there's just something about cool climate, a Sauvignon Blanc from Chile, without any wood, without any guile, without any pretense of trying to be anything more than it is, just a nice drink to go with your picnic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the prices haven't gone up the way they have in New Zealand and a couple of other places. You can find great wines for $10, and they're just magical with all the green things coming out of the basket. One of the wines that I had the other day with a green salad with a wild array of little greens, little microgreens and exotic greens,
mm-hmm.
field greens, was from Viramonte in the Casablanca Valley. It sells for $10. You see it everywhere. You stick it in the ice on the bottom of your picnic basket or cooler there. You don't need to chill it out that much, and it's just a wonderful drink with the green stuff.
Okay, the white is, to me, a little more obvious, but the reds are tricky because you've got all those sweet flavors. Maybe it's barbecue or whatever. What red would work?
Well, it's funny that you bring up reds right now, because if you hike right on over the Andes and end up in the Mendoza in Argentina, you can take advantage of the one place on Earth where the dollar is still worth more than the local currency. The only place is Argentina, and that means that the wines coming from there are going to be super inexpensive. And if you find a wine that nobody wants but the Argentinians, and that's a wine made from a grape called Bonarda. It's an Italian grape, sort of a Rodney Dangerfield of Italy grape, gets no respect in Italy. But it goes over to Argentina, gets lots of respect amongst the Argentinians, but nobody knows about it outside of there. It is a thin-skinned, goofy, mouth-watering, acidic red grape that produces these blueberry, blackberry, juice bomb wines that are $10 at most. You can find them for $6, $7, $8. You drink the youngest wine possible. In fact, you treat it like it's a white wine. You throw it in the cooler or in the bottom of the igloo so it's swimming around all the slushy ice in the water.
Right.
For 15, 20 minutes, you pull that out, and that's going to be just about every bit as delicious with everything coming out of the picnic basket as that Sauvignon Blanc from Chile is. I mean, they're just these two. You could probably just take those two, and then if you want to make a rosé, mix them together, but I don't really say that that's the way to go.
That goes against that whole the vow you take as a wine person,
exactly.
Right? Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Hey, Josh, thank you.
My pleasure.
Joshua Wesson is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops and senior director of wine, beer, and spirits at the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company. Now, you can find Josh's picnic wine picks on the website, along with my menu and recipes for a Sunday picnic in the park. That's splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out our newest online challenge. You could be our gastrosexual of the month. Now, if you're someone who prides themselves on their culinary prowess and uses it to impress and, yes, woo others, this contest is for you. All the details are at splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Coming up, the curry brief from Raghavan Iyer, artichokes, and the MSG you never knew. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Is a country with 23 languages and 1,600 dialects. Now, with that diversity from place to place, you might surmise that there are some differences as well in the foods from place to place. Now, you can get a vivid picture of that diversity by focusing on the dish that is India's calling card to the world and one of the world's most misunderstood dishes. I'm talking about curry. Curry is what drove Indian Food Authority Raghavan Iyer to crisscross India from north to south and east to west for his latest book, 660 Curries, The Gateway to the World of Indian Cooking. Raghavan, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Len.
What were you thinking? 660 curries?
Well, the idea looked great on a bar napkin after two Bombay Sapphire martinis. But I think the title itself also shows you the diversity and the depth of the world of Indian curries. And, you know, as you know, to an Indian, what's interesting is you mentioned the 23 languages in India, and none of the language has the word curry. We have words that sound similar to curry, but these are all words that signify dishes that have a sauce to it. So to us, it's all about sauces, and that really is the bottom line.
And curry was something that the British
absolutely gave. They did an amazing job of marketing the concept of curry powders, capturing the flavors of Indian curries in a concept called curry powder, which I give them total credit for, but the word itself is not Indian.
So to an Indian, curry simply means something with a sauce.
Absolutely. And to give you the definition of the curry, which I talk about it in the book, it's any dish that consists of either meat, fish, poultry, legumes, vegetables, or fruits simmered in or covered with a sauce, gravy, or other liquid that is redolent with any number of freshly ground and very fragrant spices and or herbs.
This leaves us wide open. Well, okay, with all this diversity, do you think you could give me a thumbnail sketch of some of the regional differences in taste in India?
Absolutely, because when you think about the world of curries, we think about the seven Asian taste elements: hot, sweet, sour, bitter, salty, astringent, umami.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have an aromatic component, which comes from spices like cinnamon and cloves and cardamom and cumin seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you look at the flavors of the northern regions, you've got some of those flavors I talked about, very typical in some of the blends called garam masalas.
Which some of us are familiar with.
It's warming spices that I alluded to, like cloves, cinnamon, cardamom, peppercorns. Mm-hmm. A lot of their sauces have a little bit more of a richness to it, cream-based sauces, tomato-based sauces, spinach sauces. But when you go to the south, The sauces are much different. Lots of tamarind, fresh coconut, chilies, lots of seafood that's consumed along the coastal areas.
Right.
And when you go to the east and west, you start to see combinations happening, sophisticated blends put together from the north, some spices from the north, some from the south. And they come up with their own combinations using ingredients that are local. And you've got some very interesting diversity in textures and flavors and aromas.
I'd like you to step us through making a curry.
Can I confess that I'm a potato-holic? Oh,
all right, absolutely. We could do a potato curry.
Well, absolutely.
But the thing I would love for you to do, I know you probably have your own way of doing this, but talk about the spices, because I gather that's the place you usually begin, right?
Yes, and in fact, there are some curries that don't have spices in it, but it has fresh herbs. And but when you think about spices, which is to me is the backbone of Indian curries, even though it's the sauce that makes a curry what it is. But if you take a spice like cumin seed, for instance, we can extract 8 distinct flavors from a given spice, whether we use it raw, whether it's ground raw, whether it's toasted, left whole, ground after it has been toasted, roasted in some kind of a oil, left whole, ground after it has been roasted, soaked in some kind of a liquid, used whole, ground after it has been soaked in some kind of liquid. So you're looking at 8 very distinct flavors and tastes. But you take that concept and multiply that by the hundreds of spices we have, you've peeked into the world of Indian curries.
The variety is literally endless.
It is. And so I wanted to do 1,001 curries, but we ended up, I got tired after 660.
We'd have to be sending you care packages in the kitchen. You'd be on your knees testing recipes. Okay, so we've got, all right, give us the basic concept then, how we put a curry together.
To me, you know, when you build a curry, you always start off with an oil of some kind. Mm-hmm. I love to use canola oil because it's It's got a high smoke point. It's got not much flavors to that, which is perfect for getting in all the flavors from the spices. You heat up the oil. I usually will maybe you can start with sizzling some cumin seeds in oil, which has an aromatic component to it. And as soon as it turns brown in about 10 seconds, you can throw in a combination. Oftentimes what I will do is to take peanuts, garlic, chilies, and ginger. And you can actually pound the mélange in a mortar and a pestle or a food processor. And then you could sizzle that in the oil and stir fry that. And so you have another combination of layers of tastes. And then you can actually throw in your potatoes in this instance. Brown that lightly. And if you want a little bit of a color, you certainly can use turmeric, which is what gives commercial curry powders that yellow color.
Right, exactly.
But you can certainly leave it out. But turmeric has a lot of medicinal properties to it. And then you can add your liquid, which turns this into a curry. Everything from spinach puree to you could do nut purees to yogurt to cream to even water. Throw in a little bit of salt and then let it simmer. And then once your potatoes are done, tender, which will break down also because of its starchiness, you have a nice body to the sauce. And then you've got a phenomenal curry that is very quick and easy to put together. So it's great even for breakfast.
How do you serve a curry? Must you always have rice with it? Are there certain accompaniments?
Not necessarily. You could do curries with breads. Most of all our breads are actually flatbreads. And that's our utensil. Basically, you tear up pieces of the bread and wrap it around the curry and eat it. We eat with our fingers. And so breads are great. You could take the rice, which is your base for the curry. You can pour your curry over it. You could eat the rice and the curry with it. I talk about accompaniments like lentil wafers, poppards, or poppadoms.
Oh, you can buy those. Yeah,
you can buy those. And I usually flame toast them because it's got a nice flavor. Plus, it's healthy to boot.
Yeah.
And then you could do different chutneys, different pickles and condiments, yogurt-based accompaniments.
How many potato curries are in the book?
Oh, God. I would say at least maybe 100.
Really?
Well, and again, it's not primarily potatoes, but I may have potatoes with vegetables or potatoes with meats and so on. So, you know, so if anybody from the potato board is listening, I'm here.
Raghavan, thank you.
Thanks, Len, for having me on.
Raghavan Iyer is author of 660 Curries, The Gateway to the World of Indian Cooking. Now, you can try one of Raghavan's potato curries. You can find the recipe for chunky potatoes with garlic and peanuts on the website, splendidtable.org. Russ Parsons is what you might call a food writer's food writer. He's been food and wine journalist for the LA Times over two decades, and he's garnered an armload of awards. Although Russ has written on nearly every aspect of food imaginable, his special focus has been agriculture. His latest book is How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. Hey, Russ, welcome back.
It's great to be here again, Lynn. Thank you.
Russ, I'd like to talk about artichokes. Is it true that they only come from one town in California?
There is one town in California named Castroville. It's just a little burg. It's just north of Monterey, right on the Pacific Ocean. And from within 10 miles of that town, something like 85% of all of the artichokes that are grown in the United States come. It's an amazing kind of, it's a relic of an old kind of agriculture from when people didn't really eat artichokes that much, I guess.
Yeah. When are they in season?
Artichokes have two seasons, two prime seasons, and then there's a slump in the middle where they slow down. It's early in the spring and then late in the summer, like late summer, early fall. In between, they're available, but they don't bear as heavily, so there aren't quite as many of them, and they're likely to be more expensive.
So when you're buying artichokes, what should you look for?
The first thing that you look for with an artichoke isn't something that you actually look for. Pick it up, hold it next to your ear, and give it a good squeeze. If you hear a squeak, that's a good sign, because what happens with artichokes is that the leaves lose their crispness. Mm-hmm. And when they're squeaking like that and they offer some resistance, that's a really good sign. Don't worry about black spots on the outside or on the cut end of the stem or any of that. Artichokes have an enzyme in them that starts to blacken immediately when it's in contact with the air.
So that's not to worry about it, any of that.
That's not to worry about. Now, when you're peeling artichokes, when you're cutting them up and stuff, you want to minimize that as much as possible because it will show up in the dish. So when you've cut up an artichoke, put it in water in which you've cut and squeezed the lemon.
Mm-hmm.
The water will keep the oxygen away. The lemon, the acidity from the lemon will delay that enzymatic reaction.
How long will an artichoke keep? How should you store it?
They'll keep probably a week in the refrigerator, depending on, you want to keep them in a bag. You don't want to wash them first. I mean, there's a tendency with sometimes to wash them first, but if there's any moisture on the surface, that will start to break down the peel and it'll let infection in.
You say something in the book that's interesting. You say if you cook them for a brief amount of time, they have one flavor, and if you cook them for a long time, they have another flavor.
Artichokes contain a compound that's called cinerin. And it's got this weird capacity of turning everything that you taste afterwards sweet. But it's also heat volatile. So if you cook artichokes very briefly, you get that artichoke reaction where you drink a glass of water and the water tastes sweet.
Right. Yeah,
now,
yeah.
In those cases, I think it's great to pair it with as many big flavors as you can. Pair them with black olives and lots of garlic and lemon and, really build it up. But if you cook it for longer at a low heat, what happens as it simmers is that cinerin starts to vaporize. It goes away, and what's left behind is sweet, but not that kind of metallic sweetness. And so it's a much more subtle flavor that you need to, pair that with more subdued flavors, prosciutto and cream and things like that.
Do you ever eat them raw?
They're great raw. What you need to do is peel it down to the heart and then shave it very, very thinly, like on a mandolin or one of those little Japanese mandolins, and then toss them with some lemon juice and olive oil, shave some Parmigiano Reggiano over it. That's a really great salad.
That sounds fabulous. Hey, Russ, thank you.
Thank you.
L.A. Times food and wine journalist Russ Parsons is the author of How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. By the way, Russ says baby artichokes can be a good buy, so keep your eyes out for them. Now, Russ left us with a recipe for the bigger ones. It's artichoke stuffed with ham and pine nuts, and you can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Remember Chinese restaurant syndrome, the idea that if you ate food with MSG in it, you'd have a bad reaction to it? Maybe you remember the bans on MSG and things like baby food. Maybe, too, you follow the assumption of culinary purists that good food doesn't need any flavor boost from this suspect substance. Well, New York Times reporter Julia Moskin has been digging into MSG. Julia, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Julia, was MSG banished from restaurants and food production and home kitchens?
Well, not altogether. It was banned from commercial baby foods, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
And it really didn't need to be banned because there was such a public outcry against it after this one letter was published to the New England Journal of Medicine, which led to a great conviction of something called Chinese restaurant syndrome.
It was a long time ago.
That was in 1968 when the letter came out, and apparently the New England Journal of Medicine had never received as much mail as it did following that article, with many people reporting that they had experienced numbness and palpitations and weakness after eating Chinese food. It's a very, very common perception that does persist to this day. Now, Chinese restaurant syndrome was debunked, but the idea of MSG as some sort of toxin was very firmly in place, and while Accent and Kitchen Bouquet and other MSG-containing products remained on the shelves, they simply were not really part of many food-conscious people's kitchens after that.
All right, but now here's the thing. It disappeared, but you say it really didn't disappear.
Yes, it's come back.
In what form?
In spades. Wow. I was amazed to find how many things that monosodium glutamate is, I would say, not exactly concealed in, but it did come back under other names, such as hydrolyzed soy protein, hydrolyzed vegetable protein.
That's in everything.
It's in absolutely everything. It's in canned tuna. It's in every bag of Doritos. It's in cheese goldfish. It's in things at the health food store, things like Bragg's amino acids.
Uh-huh.
That, according to several chemists, they say biochemically it's the same thing as monosodium glutamate.
But now monosodium glutamate, is there any science that says it's bad for us?
Well, that's a very hotly debated issue. I myself have never received as much mail as I did after this story. A great deal of it from people who are quite convinced that MSG has a very bad effect on them. The scientific evidence is, of course, that if you eat a large amount of anything salty at one sitting, that you will probably experience some bloating, possibly to the point of numbness. But no, there have not been any large-scale studies done since 1995, which is when the FDA commissioned a very, very large study that found that for the vast majority of people, it has no effect whatsoever.
Now, from what you say in the article, and I've heard this elsewhere as well, MSG is essentially the structure of this famous fifth taste, umami, the element that lifts other flavors. Now, food types are knocking themselves out to get umami into their food, you know, with mushrooms or whatever, if they just sprinkle some MSG on, wouldn't they get the same effect?
Well, that is certainly what the inventor of ramen believed, because that was really based on the idea of the flavor packet, that you could essentially create a dashi, which is a fundamental broth of Japanese cuisine, like the equivalent of stock in French cuisine, that you could really have a reasonable facsimile of a serious dashi in a flavor packet and create a soup that would be satisfying. And indeed, many people have found it to be very satisfying.
And there's MSG in there.
There was MSG in there, absolutely. It was patented in the year 1908, and there is going to be a large centenary celebration in Tokyo, in fact, in September.
Well, so much for banishing from diet. Okay. Julia, thank you.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Julia Moskin is a reporter for the New York Times dining section. Now, her piece on MSG was published in the March 5th, 2008 issue of the paper. It's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is an alligator pear? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But right now, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is an alligator pear? Well, the answer is, it's an avocado. Alligator pear is an old name for the fruit. Obviously not the choice of anyone trying to sell it. It dropped out of fashion in the United States maybe around the 1920s. It was replaced by avocado. But this is a case of what's in a name, and there's always a lot of history. The word avocado came out of the ancient Aztec name for the fruit, aguacatl. Now, you can trace how Europeans took over the Caribbean by tracking how each group twisted that name to their own language. The words avocado and alligator pear first appeared in print in 1696, in a catalog of Jamaican plants by a nobleman named Sir Hans Sloane. But I like another name that the avocado had, midshipman's butter, for what it gave Caribbean sailors long ago. Now, did you know that the avocado's been around since 6000 BC? And at my last count, there were 115 different varieties of avocado, and no two taste exactly alike. As far as eating avocados, the Aztecs did the guacamole thing. You know, they mashed them with the chilies and the tomato and the lime. Spanish explorers liked them with honey. And my friend, the late Sam Arnold, who was a Southwest culinary historian, and by the way, the queso grande of the International Connoisseurs of Green and Red Chili, well, Sam mashed avocados the way the Aztecs did, with jalapenos and lime juice. Then he mixed it into softened vanilla ice cream and froze it. I think that won a few chili contests, but I can't quite remember. Anyway, you can get the recipe for sweet avocado green chili ice cream on the website, splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid.
It's time for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Let's get to the phones. Let's see. We have got Peg from Seattle, Washington. Hey, Peg, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, how are you?
I am good.
Well, I had the great privilege over Christmas to go to Zanzibar off the coast of Tanzania. And they are famous for their spices.
Oh, yeah.
And for great spice tours, which were just a kick. And it was, I think my friend and I imagined like going to a vineyard.
Yeah.
But it was really walking through the jungle.
How amazing.
And having two kind of young guys go, well, this is a nutmeg tree and this is a, you know, vanilla bean.
And over there's the allspice and right over there.
Exactly. No, it was exactly that. Cloves and cinnamon, real cinnamon. And
oh, my.
But one thing I brought home that I'm confused by is it says Zanzibar red curry.
Yeah.
But it's not curry paste like red curry in
Thailand. Like Thailand. Yeah, right, like Thailand.
Right. And every recipe that I've looked up has been red curry paste like Thai tradition.
Right.
This smells more like turmeric than it does like a powdered curry mix. And the only hint on it at all is that, you know, to use it for chicken tandoor. So I wonder if it's more coloring.
It may be,
flavoring.
Well, first of all, you know, the Indian influence on that part of the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, and from what I understand, depending on whose history you read,
right,
China, India, you know, probably all of Southeast Asia.
Everywhere. And the Omanis actually held it for a long time. So Middle Eastern influence is huge. Architecturally.
Yeah.
And
was the food incredible?
It was incredible. We had just incredible, incredible fish every night. Uh-huh. So, it was lovely. Plus, we were staying at a lovely place on the north end of the island run by a gentleman who is from Zanzibar but is now British. And his wife, and they run this nice set of cottages, and we actually had Christmas there, and they did a traditional Christmas dinner, so it was right on the beach. So
sounds glorious. I had to turn down a trip to Zanzibar a long time ago, and I have
kicked myself. Don't do that
again. I would never do it again. I kicked myself 16 times over. It was something I couldn't avoid, but it sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it's terrific.
Okay, your red curry. I think you probably, thinking of all the heavy Indian influence, I think you've got something that would be used for chicken tandoor.
Okay.
So that means you would mix it with whole milk yogurt.
Oh, okay.
And technically, the chicken is skinned for tandoori chicken.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I think you know the drill. You would blend the curry powder. Have you tasted it, by the way?
I haven't. But like I said, it's very smell-wise.
Smells a lot like turmeric.
Yeah.
And I'd put a little bit on my tongue because you may want to add something. You may want to add cumin, or you may want to add black pepper, or you may want to add something else. And I always throw some oil in it because I want to just... you know, the yogurt is something which, with the culture, it can actually, people say it moistens, but I think it can actually sometimes dry some things out.
Okay.
I would say marinate that chicken for 8 hours, even overnight, and
Do
that roast But I would also try sautéing that into sautéed onions, you know, that you're going to use for vegetables.
Or with lentils or something.
Right, because I think you could use this in any number of ways. They may not be terribly traditional.
Sure.
But, you know, I'm just thinking a red curry paste or red curry powder like that.
Right.
Can you imagine doing a mess of red onion, sautéing into it, and then browning cauliflower?
Oh, yeah.
Wouldn't that be wonderful? Or cauliflower and potato, and then you could add some broth or water and just let that simmer until it's tender. I think it would be wonderful.
Yeah, I think the color is going to be the key. It's very bright.
Yeah, and I think cauliflower or potatoes would be beautiful, and you could throw in fresh ginger to give it that vibrance.
Oh, yeah, you bet.
Hey, right. Peg, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
You take care.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. We've got Susan calling from Wake Forest, North Carolina. Susan, what do you want to talk about?
Hi there. We were in Italy.
Uh-huh.
Brought back with us a bottle of La Polenza Cinque Terre. It's a white wine. We tasted in the village of Cornelia.
Oh, you were in the Cinque Terre.
We were, and it was beautiful. We're still pinching ourselves. It was like a dream. It was just beautiful.
I think we should explain why don't you explain where we're talking about in Italy?
It is along the Ligurian coast.
Northern part of the
northern part of Italy, and it's often referred to as the Italian Riviera.
Yeah.
The Cinque Terre are five little villages all linked together by trails, and they are heavily terraced, and white wine is the predominant wine that is produced there, and they still harvest the grapes in the traditional old way of hiking up the terraced trails and carrying baskets on their heads to collect these grapes.
You couldn't get in there with a machine if you tried.
No.
These are cliffs. You should imagine that there are mountains coming right down to the sea, and these five towns are carved almost in some cases into those cliff sides down to the sea. And it used to be that there were almost no roads going in there, that you could only get to it on foot. It's improved now, but still, it's a glorious place to spend time. Oh, so now the name of the wine was?
La Polenza.
Oh, yes. It's a wonderful white wine. As I remember, it has a fruity quality, and it's got a fair amount of complexity. So what do you want? Are you saying you want to know what to eat with it or what to do with it?
A fabulous meal that you would serve to complement this wine.
Oh, boy. Well, Liguria is the home of great fresh herbs. I mean, I always think of Liguria as the place where you cook with greens. One thing that you could do is, even though this is a little south of pesto country, is wait for the new basil, you know, when the plants are 6 inches high, and make a pesto with that new basil, which is very gentle. You don't want to overdo the garlic. You want to use a buttery oil from Liguria, something that says on it it's from Imperia. That's the area that the oil comes from. And then you would do pasta. You might cook new potatoes thin sliced with the pasta, which is very traditional, and green beans. And then you toss that with your pesto. That's number one. Another thing is to think about doing, this is definitely a wine for seafood. Uh-huh. I would do a seafood stew. You could do mussels and shrimp and any kind of fin fish that looks like it's really fresh. And you could do a really delicate broth, a white wine broth. Cook some fish first in some water and white wine to get a little bit of a fish broth. That's fish you'll overcook. You know, you won't be eating that fish.
Okay.
But I would have a little celery, a little carrot, a little onion, a little parsley, a little garlic. Okay? Small amount of tomato, a fair amount of broth and white wine. I'd sauté the vegetables, and you'd have a little garlic in there. And then I would add the white wine broth from the fish, and I would let that simmer for about 20 minutes. I'd add a small amount of tomato. You want this to be gentle. Mm-hmm. Now, you could put that aside in the fridge for a day and the next day, but just before you serve it, you would add clams and mussels and cook until they open, okay? And then you drop in maybe some shrimp and some, you know, some simple fin fish. Just cook it for a minute or two. And you put that out with lots of coarse, chewy bread.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes.
You know, I mean, and maybe a little good olive oil on the table that you can sprinkle over the stew with black pepper, and you drink that wine. And you will be back there in a hot minute.
Oh.
Oh, gosh. It's
wonderful.
Oh, it's such a beautiful part of Italy.
It is.
I'm jealous. Susan, you enjoy.
Thank you so much. You've been great help.
Well, I hope you enjoy.
We will.
You take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Take care. La Polenza is the wine we're talking about. It's a white wine, and it comes from the Cinque Terre, which, by the way, means the five earths. Call us, 800-537-5252. Well, food prices keep climbing, but our incomes don't. You buy store brands, you buy low on the food chain, but have you thought of buying salvage or surplus foods? Wall Street Journal reporter David Kesmodell did an article on this new trend in grocery stores. David, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What are these stores about?
Well, these stores sell products that food manufacturers had sold in conventional grocery stores, but maybe didn't sell particularly well, so they canceled that line of goods, but they mm-hmm. still had leftover product, and they then turned to this segment called salvage or surplus groceries, and they try to sell these goods at really low prices.
So is there any fresh food involved here, like produce and stuff?
These stores do commonly have some produce. Mm-hmm. Usually that's procured in a traditional way. So these salvage stores mostly will have prepared foods, frozen food, frozen meat products, mm-hmm. that sort of
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they will, because some of the shoppers to their stores, this is their only grocery stop,
right.
They will cater to those customers by also having a small selection of produce, and they will also supply milk that is procured in traditional ways.
Mm-hmm. What is the difference between surplus and salvage?
That's a great question. These two terms come up to describe this industry because it's a little complicated to describe the industry simply.
Mm-hmm.
The term surplus comes up because in many cases, these products are excess inventory that the food manufacturers produced and can't sell in conventional supermarket chains, and so it's extra product. Now, the word salvage comes in because some of this product is damaged in some way,
mm-hmm.
But the product is still good enough to eat. For example, you'll find slightly dented boxes of Kellogg's cereal at these stores or cans that might have a few nicks in them, that sort of thing.
Do both stores carry things that are sort of past their best buy dates?
Yeah, it's common for them to sell product that is near or past what's often called the best if eaten by date.
Uh-huh.
And the reason is the manufacturers use those dates to kind of estimate when freshness will start to deteriorate.
Right, right.
But they also often use those dates just so that they can move their inventory in an efficient manner through their supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
And really, quite often, I'm told by consumers and by the store owners that the food tastes just fine, so long as it's not, you know, going way beyond that date.
Yeah.
Another issue here is there's state regulation of these stores, just the way any food seller is regulated by health departments. These stores can't sell milk that's outdated because that's unsafe.
Right.
Baby formula and, you know, baby food also is closely regulated for that issue.
What kind of savings are we talking about? What percentage?
Mm-hmm. Well, in some cases, you're talking about, you know, 70% or higher.
Wow.
Off regular prices. You know, here's one example. I went to a store in Coatesville, Pennsylvania. It's called Amelia's Grocery Outlet.
Mm-hmm.
And a woman there bought four bottles of a Kraft salad dressing for a total of $1. And the woman who was buying it was really experienced at shopping at these stores. She told me she used to work in the food industry, and she said she understood that, you know, you can eat this stuff long past the sell-by date, and you're fine.
I guess it is buyer beware, but still an interesting thing to track. David, thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, no problem.
David Quesmodel is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. His article on salvaged groceries appeared in the February 22, 2008 edition of the paper. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this quote from our favorite, Anonymous, who said, "Training is everything. The peach was once a bitter almond." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, information on everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Not only will you find our newsletter and podcast, you'll find information on our book, How to Eat Supper. Now, you can find it all at splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.